Accession number 14974, Paul Armstrong, reel 22.
I think because they were rather.
Mr. Armstrong, reel 22. You joined the Canadians at about this time, Mr. Armstrong. What was the date?
It would be sometime in September, I think. Oh, wait a minute, no. August. Yes, July.
Round about that time.
End of July, beginning of August, I would think. I'm not going to swear to it now because we were being army troops. We were dog's body, having quite a lot more equipment than the ordinary field engineers had. We were able to do things for people to save them sending up for specialist units. And so we were literally, I can safely say, dog's body is a very good description.
How far might you have been behind the front line? How far back would you be?
In some cases, a matter of 2 or 3 days. In some cases, up to 2 and 3 weeks. It was very difficult because the line fluctuated and it depended on how the engineers of the various arms were faring, what casualties they had, what jobs they had. I have a book here which shows all the Bailey bridges, for instance, that were erected during the advance, and you will be astonished to see what work was done. I can only conclude we were sent to the Canadians because they were short of sapper power, and it was alone. And so we moved up, and I remember we went to meet the Canadians first. My Colonel Brighton was a Scots-Canadian, and he'd done a lot of engineering works in Canada as well as America. And when he met the brigadier of this Canadian unit, the name which I can't remember, they had met on a previous occasion doing some job in Canada, which was a great help. And this brigadier said to the colonel, well, you must go and back up. We've got an advance going up a road here. Go on up and back them up, see what you can do for them, which was rather elastic. So the colonel and I drove up. See, why I'm saying I was the only other officer beside the colonel who'd seen any active service. All our current officers, and not all our men, but a number of our men, were new boys. So, of course, the colonel tended to use me to go with him, because as an infantryman I could read a map, and I was used to the necessaries that were required in a reconnaissance.
What rank were you at this time?
Lieutenant. This I found most interesting. It was far better than being in the camp. This to me was much, much more exciting. It made me feel that I hadn't completely lost my infantry training. Well, this time we went up. I'm not going to be sure, but it could be the Toronto Scottish. But we met the colonel and his staff at a road crossing, and they pointed to a road where there were clearly and obviously mines. And this colonel asked if we could move them. And my colonel said to me, well, what about it? So I said, right, I'll go forward and have a look. And I went forward with my batman, orderly, and started to examine the first mine. And I cleared that, and I found, as it happened, that it wasn't even armed. I moved on to the next mine and started doing it, and examine it. And suddenly, I heard a vehicle coming down the road, and a jeep was coming towards me. And I thought, well, this is interesting. So moved to the side of the road, and a Canadian officer in this jeep went driving past it flat out. What he meant by that, I couldn't tell. And as it happened, he went over at least one mine and nothing happened. So the Canadians all started moving down. And when my colonel came alongside, I said, and what's the form here? He said, they were so anxious to carry on that this adjutant volunteered to take a chance. I said, well, I hope he's just as lucky next time. As a matter of interest, my chaps moved the rest of these mines on the road, and they hadn't been armed, but this was a tactic that often occurred when you were withdrawing in case you came back again in a counterattack. And so it would be a bad thing if you laid and armed your minefield and then had to drive over it and clear it to get ahead. It's one of those things that happens.
Were they buried or lying on the
surface? No, they were lying on the road, but they had sods and earth round them. You could see there were mines there, but they were covered to a degree. Just, of course, the sort of thing that the German did, that I would do, to coax the enemy to do what the adjutant did and to drive over it.
There weren't then supporting vehicles like flail tanks?
No, not at that time. Flail tanks were mainly used when the infantry were going to move forward in an area where a counterattack could be established, where covering fire from the enemy could be given onto these mines that had been laid. So the flail tanks went forward to operate, to swing the chains and beat the ground, and any fire from the enemy would mainly be small arms up to and including machine gun, and the tanks were pretty safe there. So that is why you didn't see the flail tanks there. You can normally think of the flail tank as operating only when necessary and only in an urgent assault case. About that time, we moved on. We didn't do a lot for the Canadians then. They were going faster than was expected. In fact, we were on the left flank, moving up. You can picture it moving up towards the Channel ports, you might say. That's the way we were moving. And the main fighting was taking place up the main axis through Falaise and Argentan, where the big pincer movement was at that time carrying on. So we were, I suppose, lucky in that the main enemy had been drawn into this major attack in the Falaise Gap. I think one of the silliest things that I did during the war then, we found a warehouse which the Germans had been using as a sort of ordnance depot, and in it there were several small, tiny little tanks which were only about 8 foot long. The Germans called them Goliath, and what their purpose was. They were literally full of explosives, and they used to set them off controlled from the back so that they would hit any defences, wire and the rest of it, and then the Germans would detonate them the way they went.
So it's kind of a remote controlled vehicle.
To a degree. Not altogether, but they were, to a degree, could be controlled from behind. This is what we assumed. But I admit, if they hit anything when they were fully armed, they went up. And why I say I was so stupid, two of my friends and I were playing dodgems with three of them, and we'd forgotten to check whether they were empty, unarmed or what they were. The sort of thing that one doesn't think about at the time.
What exactly did they look like?
Exactly like a large tank in miniature. You might almost think of the dodgems when this is what we were playing at. One man could squeeze into it. He wasn't supposed to, anyhow. It was supposed to be directed and aimed, and presumably the driver jumped out. But if you can think of a miniature tank, as I say, about 8 foot long, that's all there would be, and about, three foot wide. But they were packed full of explosives, and they were a very interesting piece of equipment. The Germans had some marvellous equipment. They used to regard our equipment, as they told me afterwards, later on at the end of the war when we were talking to people, they told us that the only equipment that they admired and longed for in the Allied forces was the Bailey Bridge and the Jeep. Otherwise, they regarded our equipment as rubbish. As we were travelling up there, we came to one village called Poix, P-O-I-X, and the local resistance had taken control at that time. As they were doing all the way up, as we moved along, the local resistance took over, flushed out German supporters and German collaborators, of course. And the chief of the resistance was dying to show us his prisoners, collaborators. And he was so excited we couldn't quite tell what he was talking about until he took us into this house. And there in a barred room were three women with shaved heads. And they were literally in rags, but they were living in their own excrement. It was a most ghastly and disgusting sight. The town was a pretty little town. The people looked quite normal people, but these three women were just kept in that state, filthy, dirty, stinking to high heaven, shaven-headed. They did look appalling. The first collaborators I'd seen treated that way, a matter of interest. And Colonel Bryan was very, very upset about this, although he's a tough man who I've never seen frightened of anything in his life. He couldn't bear it, and he really dressed these people down good and proper and made every effort to get them released. Whether they did release them, I don't know. We moved on from there. Another interesting thing that was happening to me at that time was we were beginning to move in the same road that we'd marched down in 1940. And it was very interesting that eventually I was able to go to a place where my friend Vane from Stockton had left his laundry, and I picked it up and I returned it to him when I came back to England in 45, actually in 46, because he was in Burma then. Very interesting. very kindly, honest people that, as I think I mentioned to you early on when we were withdrawing, one would have thought that they would have been very, very upset about us retreating as we were, but they never showed any ill feeling, and we were equally, we were terribly ashamed.
How were they receiving you as you went through?
Oh, everywhere. It was absolute. It was to them the end of a nightmare. I know that people said, yes, they were living there under the Germans, and they were working for the Germans, but it was a living nightmare. They didn't know who was reporting on them. You didn't know whether your neighbour was a collaborator. And there were a lot of collaborators, whatever said and done. And the German police, I'm shocked to say, collaborated, if you wish to call it, with the Germans. And I've talked to various of my friends that escaped prisoners of war, and they said they were warned over and over to avoid the police.
This is the French police?
The French police. To avoid the French police. That, to me, is a shocking thing.
Did you come across any evidence of very bad deeds done against the civilian population by the Germans, particularly as they retreated?
Not in the area that we were in, no. I think myself that the main thing that was happening was they were retreating, and you hadn't much time to bother about civilians. The civil population had the sense to get out of sight, mainly. And most French houses seemed to have a cellar, and most French people seemed to get into them. One found bodies, but I didn't see any signs. There were several very well documented cases, but when you think of the vast numbers involved, and when you think of the number of SS divisions who'd fought in Poland and Russia, where life was very, very cheap, it possibly surprising there wasn't more. I don't know.
How were you? What were your first impressions of the Canadians as soldiers?
I like the Canadians.
Did they differ in their, in some ways, with the, to the British soldier?
The British soldier's a man who isn't easily upset. He's a man who gets on with the job, and he carries out. He'll grumble like mad. I possibly have given you the impression that my chaps never grumbled. They moan like Billio wherever we went, and in fact I remember being told off by Colonel Vier of the 2nd Battalion when he asked me how my men were, and I said fine. He said no complaints, and I said no sir. He said, God, there's something wrong, find out what it is. That perhaps explains it. So please regard it as being read that my chaps did moan, whether they were infantrymen or whether they were sappers, they moaned. But it was like a sort of drone in the background. One just took it as the noise from a hive when everybody's happy.
And the Canadians?
Now, the Canadians, they're not as gung-ho as the Americans, but they're more reckless than the British. The Canadians want to get on, get on, get on. Whereas our people are quite content to work out a plan and then just methodically put it into operation. When necessary, they'll go fast and they'll go furiously. But I always felt the Canadians had a tendency, like the Americans, just to go flat out without consideration. I'm probably wrong because I'm just an English observer. I don't know. By that time, quite a while's gone on, various things have happened. One of the comical things that did happen to me, the Canadians were 3 or 4 days ahead of us at that time, and I was moving up in my jeep doing a recce for our next camp, and two Canadian infantrymen flagged me down. I thought, this is odd. Clear as crystal, there was no one about, and I didn't know what these chaps were doing, but they asked if they could go that away, and that away was to the front. So I thought, well, I'll give them a lift. And I said, hop aboard. And as we drove out, they said, oh, by the way, sir, do you mind if we just get under this tarpaulin? I said, oh, I see. They said, if you can just drop us in front of our lance, we'll be quite happy. Well, they were in my jeep there. There was little I could do, so I kept on moving. And when we got through the rear echelon of the Canadians, I thought, this is fairly safe. And on the quiet road, I said to them, there's no one about. So they both leapt out and disappeared into the field. Obviously, they'd been blind drunk, as they often were, and they'd been left behind, and they knew perfectly well that the punishment was pretty severe. The Canadians were a little bit more severe than our people were. However, when my batman rearranged the tarpaulin over my jeep, he found two bottles of Calvados left, whether it was getting rid of evidence or whether it was in thanks, I don't know.
You mentioned moving up to look for camps for your next stoppings, but how did you camp at night?
Well, up till then, we'd been literally finding a place, an area, a field, large enough, safe enough to take, depending on how long we expected to be in the area. If it was only going to be for 2 or 3 days, well, it was just a case of marking out where the tents were going to be erected and where headquarters was going to be and where the traffic lines were. This was the sort of thing one did. And then to notify whoever was calling on us for assistance of any sort. Likewise, to let the service corps know where we are so we would eat.
But your food was coming from British or Canadian sources?
Canadian then. Yes, Canadian at that time. We were completely away from the British sources. We hadn't any contact for a few weeks. And in fact, we didn't have any contact with them until we got up to the assault on Boulogne. The Canadians were going to do the assault on Boulogne, and the brigadier asked Colonel Bryden if he would care to watch it. As one might say, would like to go to the cinema or the theatre. Quite interesting. So I went up with the CO and we watched this, and Bryden said, well, we seem to be a long way off, can we not get in on the action? So Brigadier said, you may if you wish, but I'll send you up to one of the Canadian units. He said, I've got to be, naturally he was in control of his brigade. So we just moved forward. And we joined this battalion, and the colonel asked the CO straight away if there was anything he could do, and he said, well, at the moment, no, nothing. He said, we're just going to be in and winkle these people out. And so it was interesting, because the Germans, by that time, were disheartened. They knew they were cut off. And they'd been told by Hitler that if the anyone surrendered, the engaging habit they had was not only would they be shot when they got back, but the families would be shot. And of course, this does discourage someone from surrendering.
And what condition were the German troops in?
Oh, good. Good. There were still strong, fit, well equipped, plenty of ammunition.
Were there older men that, you know, normally wouldn't take his military age, or
no,
too young?
No, these chaps were. Some of them were. That's right. Some of them were obviously second-rate troops that had been kept there. Yes, I would say so. But I thought the most interesting thing was the Canadians sent in the flamethrowers. They said they weren't going to waste time on these. They're all in these blockhouses all around the harbour areas and the citadel. So the first thing that they did was to send up the flamethrowers, which were armoured. And the interesting sight was the fact that the first one, no warning, this just a jet of petrol came across, and as it hit, it seemed to ignite. And in seconds, several chaps came running out of the blockhouse, beating flames off the clothing as much as they could. But each of the blockhouses, the bunkers, that could see this one, a white flag came out, and they came out. They knew what flamethrowers were all about. And it was interesting to see the way they tramped out with their hands up and the white flags. And about that time, we went in. One of the armoured places was the casino. And I had the pleasure of going in behind them and taking the German flag off the top of it, which I kept for several years. Another silly thing I did, we were then told to check the harbour. Oh, I suppose it was part of the job. We were supposed to check the harbour and see what sort of equipment was there and whether there was any blockage of the entrance and all the rest of it. And I remember driving my Jeep down, and I got halfway down when I heard machine gun, and I saw machine gun fire in front of me, and I thought, this isn't very funny. Did the most incredible turn I've ever done. I felt I'd almost lifted the Jeep round and shot off back again. I didn't suffer any ill effects.
Had the Germans destroyed the harbour to any great degree?
Yes, they'd done a lot of damage, as they had every harbour, a lot of damage. But it was to be expected. It was that was their orders, and that's what they did.
Was it heavily booby-trapped, the area?
Not as much as we expected, no. In fact, I was sent in, well, I went in because I was the only supper officer. We still came under 8 Corps at that time, even though we attached to Canadians. And I remember I went into the commandant's, the citadel there. I went in there, checked that for booby traps. There were none. But on a big board, a big map board in the commandant's office, there was a large plan of all the minefields, the static minefields in that Boulogne area. And I took that and sent it straight up to Chief Engineer's office for onward transmission. It would be a godsend.
Have any other outstanding memories of actually taking Boulogne?
No, it seemed to be over a lot faster than I expected. I think the Germans, as soon as they saw the Canadian armour coming in and they saw the way they were willing to use it against them, I think that they decided. You see, the worst of a town with walls is that if you're behind the walls, you're caught like a rat in a trap. And so, of course, once the Canadians breached the walls and moved in, the Germans, I presume, realised that there was little point in fighting further. And apart from odd houses where they held out, I can remember going down route towards the town hall. There was a two or three houses that had been fortified down there, and they held out for a while, but the defence wasn't what I'd seen earlier on moving up. Nothing like it.
The Canadians have been criticised, of course, for the speed at which they moved up the coast, with ports being left behind with garrisons and taking quite a while to take.
I think...
Is this fair on your experience? Fair comment?
No, I think myself that those garrisons, I think it was the decision, in fact I'm sure it was the decision of the High Command to keep the impetus of the move forward going, rather than spend time and men trying to see, Boulogne was just a waste of time. It wasn't really vital that it was cleared out. Boulogne and Calais, both the harbours had been wrecked. Calais was a similar sort of thing. And so one wasn't bothered about it. What they did hope to get quickly was Antwerp.